got some notes. The dates on these are wrong because we've had two straight snow days. And you'll notice on there I had to get my little poke in against the Patriots, and the Eagles were successful. I don't particularly like the Eagles. I've just grown so sick of the Patriots. And so go Eagles, yay, Super Bowl's over, football season's over, so baseball season's around the bend. Go Royals, even though it's looking like the Royals are going to be terrible this year. We have lost all of our best players, and I'll still be rooting for the Royals. I just think we're going to be very bad this year. Okay, now, my notes are from 2 weeks ago, so if I have to break down every bit and read ahead just to make sure I am where I need to be, forgive me for that. All right, let's go ahead and jump in on some review. Okay, so far in this semester, we've done apologetics, which is the intellectual defense of the faith. We started with my personal testimony, and then we did some New Testament apologetics, which we're going to look at again a little bit tonight. And then we did the ontological argument. I really don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the ontological argument. I don't find it all that persuasive. But basically, the ontological argument postulates the idea of a greatest possible being. And if you can imagine a greatest possible being, one of the attributes of that greatest possible being would be existence. Therefore, if he is the greatest possible being, he would exist. Not only in your mind, but in reality, therefore, God exists. You see how it's a weak, flimsy, apologetic argument. The one value I see to the ontological argument is it helps us if we get in a situation where we have to defend God against a straw man argument. So I quoted last semester when we were talking about the attributes of God, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is one of the smartest men in America. He deserves a lot of credit, not only for his academic achievements, but doing it, being raised up in, let's just call it what it is, a ghetto. And he is a figure to the black community of what they can be academically. That being said, when he, in his popular talks about God, he always seems to evoke kind of a bearded Hank Williams Jr.-like figure. And so one of the things the ontological argument helps us do is it helps us frame the argument correctly. We're not talking about just a spiritual dude, like, I don't remember the name of the painting, but where the man is reaching out and God's reaching out and they're almost touching hands. And of course, God's got a six-pack and a giant white beard like some kind of Gandalf on a weightlifting regimen. And the ontological argument helps us realize, no, we're talking about the greatest possible being, not some Greek god. Then we moved on to the cosmological argument, which is a series of arguments, and we concluded that with the Kalam cosmological argument, which I think is the strongest cosmological argument. But basically, those arguments all look at the universe as a whole, although you can also use cosmological arguments on the world around us, and says it all has to begin somewhere, that you can't have an infinite regress. So even if you don't look at stars and galaxies, look at oak trees. The oak tree came from an acorn, the acorn came from an oak tree, the oak tree came from an acorn, et cetera, et cetera. That cannot go on forever. At some point, something had to start the first, something or someone had to start the first acorn or oak tree. No matter how you look in whatever aspect of the universe, you cannot go on in infinity. You just can't keep going back. There has to be a maker, a beginner, a prime mover. The series of cosmological arguments proves that there has to be a God. And once again, if you combine that with the ontological argument, it shows us that we have a God who is the greatest possible being, including personhood, goodness, moral goodness, excellence, worthy of worship, etc. So tonight we're going to dig into the teleological argument. The teleological argument says that if you look at nature, and most teleological arguments are biological arguments, and that's probably what we're going to spend the next 2 or 3 weeks on is intelligent design, creationism, interpretations of Genesis chapter 1. But we're not going to do much on biology tonight. We're going to lay the groundwork by looking at the broader concept of design within the universe. So let's start with a little review on Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was a medieval theologian and philosopher. Honestly, this might hurt Catholics' feelings, but he was more of a philosopher than a theologian. But he was a really good theologian too. And he came up with five proofs or five arguments for the existence of God. The first four were basically just cosmological arguments formed different ways. But his fifth was a teleological argument. So let's look at his argument real quick. You have to explain Aquinas, and it's weird for me, unless I keep saying Thomas Aquinas every time. Aquinas simply points out where he's from. So more often than not, I'm probably going to refer to him as Thomas. If you look at Thomas's teachings, a lot of them go back to Aristotle. And you have to understand what Aristotle taught about causes. So let's look at a vehicle, at a car. What caused the car? Well, according to Aristotle, you've got multiple causes. You have the efficient cause, which tells us who made it, how it was made, when it was made, where it was made. So my Ford Taurus was probably made in Tennessee or Michigan, and it was made by a guy named Joe in 2002, because it's a 2003 car, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the efficient causes. You can also look at the material causes, and that would be metal, plastic, wheel. Tires aren't made from rubber, but some kind of rubber composite. All those are material causes. You have the formal cause. Now, this one's a little harder to understand, but basically, the formal cause is why something was made. What is its form? So a car exists, for the most part, to get us to point A to point B. There could be secondary causes of that, like transporting goods instead of people, or fun, you know, going for a joyride or running around a track a lot. But for the most part, the formal cause of a car is transportation. And then you've got the final cause. Actually, I think I messed that up, because final cause is the purpose. So I'll tell you what, instead of doing car, let's switch up the analogy so we can understand formal cause better. If I were to go into the kitchen and ask my wife, hey, babe, why is the pot boiling? My wife could say, I put it on the stove. That's why the pot's boiling. That's the efficient cause. She's just explaining her actions and why it's there. She could also give me a material cause and say, the electric running through the stove is using electric currents in order to generate heat through our heat source that has heated the water past its boiling point, and therefore it is boiling. That would be the material cause. It explains the breakdown of what exactly is happening. The formal cause, okay, here, this is a better way of explaining formal cause. The formal cause, she would say, that's what pots are made for. So I say, why is water boiling on the stove? She says, that's what pots are made for. If you deny the purpose of the form, you deny part of its cause. And then the final cause is, I'm going to make us some spaghetti for dinner. So all of those are true, depending on the context of what we're trying to get to. So now let's look at Thomas's teleological argument, because it deals with final causes. Thomas argues that in nature there are many non-intelligent objects that behave in predictable, usable, or useful ways. So in other words, nature shows many cases of final causes. If there was no God, if nature really was fully random, you would expect only material and formal causes. And probably not even formal causes, without a designer. So it'd mostly just be material causes plus randomness. Thomas argues that with so many final causes in nature, when you see so much purpose in nature, it is safe to assume that nature itself has a final cause and a purpose, and therefore an intelligent designer. Now, being a philosopher, he can go on with books and books and books explaining that. I think we're done. We understand Thomas. We could go in depth, but that's basically his teleological argument. In 1802, we have another theologian come along, William Paley. And he actually, I don't know if he's a theologian or more of a biologist, but William Paley wrote a book called Natural Theology. And natural theology is another term for apologetics, or at least evidentialist apologetics, the branch of apologetics that tries to look at evidence to support the existence of God, as opposed to presuppositional apologetics, which functions within the framework of the Christian worldview. So it's scripture-driven, and any philosophical or evidential evidence would have to be used within that framework. So William Paley says this. This is a direct quote. Suppose I found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. Yet why should not this answer serve for the watch as well as for the stone that happened to be lying on the ground? For this reason, and for no other, namely, that if the different parts had been differently shaped from what they are, if a different size from what they are, or placed after any other manner, or in any order other than which they are placed, either no motion at all would have been carried on in the machine, or none which would have answered the use that is now served by it. Okay, let me break that down. He's speaking in kind of revolutionary era language. Basically, he's saying, imagine you go to a forest and you look on the ground and you see a watch. Whether it's a working watch or not is beside the point, but let's assume it's a working watch. If I were to ask my buddy who is going hiking with me, there's a watch on the ground, I wonder where it came from, and he said, well, it's always been there. That's stupid. There is enough specified complexity within that watch to necessitate an explanation, Aristotle's causes. All of those causes would need to be explained. Now, I could go on that same hike and see a really pretty rock, almost like a marble-looking rock, just really pretty. And I say to my friend, hey, look at that rock. I wonder how it got here. And he said, well, it's always been there. It's just, this is the way it is. It's nature. What Paley says is that while emotionally we feel a difference between that because we know where watches come from, we're used to them, and rocks, we're used to them being in nature, and if you take a step back, we still have to explain the causes, that there are still material and formal causes and efficient causes and final causes that need to be answered for the rock just as much as for the watch. William Lane Craig expands on this when he imagines a glowing orb in the woods. And if you were to come upon a glowing orb in the woods, something that's not a watch like we're used to, and we know exactly where watches come from. They come from factories or Switzerland or depending on what kind of watch. We know what they're for and where to buy them. Go to Walmart or go to a Zales Jewelry and get a watch. And we know where rocks are. Rocks are just out there. That's what rocks are. They're made in the earth, and we can get into geological reasons, but rocks are everywhere. But imagine a glowing orb. So we don't know where it comes from, nor is it anything we've really seen before. It doesn't make any sense just to say it's always been there. Well, imagine if that glowing orb, instead of the size of a bowling ball, was the size of a car. It doesn't change the need to know where it comes from. If anything, it makes it even more of a pressing issue. Well, what if it was the size of Neosho, or Missouri, or America, or Earth, or the solar system, or the universe itself? At no point do we just say, well, that's just the way it is. We still need an explanation for where it comes from, even if it's the size of the universe. So the atheist or the naturalist or whatever other label they might give themselves, when they try to argue that, well, what's true for the universe, now I'm kind of going back into cosmological arguments here instead of teleological arguments, but there's a lot of overlap. If the atheist or whatever person tries to say, well, sure, we need to explain the watch, but we don't need to explain the universe. Well, Dr. Craig would say, why? We need to be able to explain the causes and be able to explain the design for the universe every bit as much as the solar system and the watch and the glowing orb and the rock. Now let's get to some scripture here. The Apostle Paul gives, let's be fair here, the Bible does not put a lot of time and, it's Romans chapter 1, by the way. The Bible does not put a lot of time and effort into what we call apologetics. There really is an argument to be made for American Christians being probably a little bit too infatuated with apologetics sometimes. And I'm talking about the ones that are infatuated with apologetics like myself.
Would you say that apologetics and science and social science is really the discovering of God's creation?
Yes. And that's actually a really good segue because we're going to look at Romans chapter 1, verses 16 through 25. And this is where Paul gives about as close as the Bible gets to a apologetic argument, where Paul is going to use creation as exhibit one, as evidence for the existence of God. And upon this, he will then build his moral argument, which in a way is the rest of the book. But he starts with God exists, morality exists, and then splinters out. And Romans really is in many ways the best polemic ever written in the history of the world. The only thing that I would say that might not make it such a great polemic is the last several chapters he kind of throws on some other arguments, but even if you just consider chapters 1 through 8 or 1 through 9 or 10, still a great polemic. He builds his argument very well. Now, to my American apologetic mind, his argument feels a little weak, but that's just because I'm used to more details. More details doesn't always make it more true. And so let's look at Paul's argument. Let's just go ahead and read it, and then I'll elaborate a little more. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 through 25. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Now, a lot of times when Paul uses the term Greek, sometimes there he is talking about all the rest of us. And as far as I know, I don't have any Greek blood. But in this case, I would be Greek, the way he's wording his argument, because he's building from the Jewish nation out. And for his audience, the Greeks are the next logical step from the Jews. Verse 17, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is forever blessed. Amen. Now, if we were to take these verses and arrange them as an apologetic argument, either he is making an argument from beauty or he is making a teleological design argument, and maybe both. Because if you think about it, the argument from beauty, how lovely the world is and everything, is a teleological argument because aesthetics is a form of design. So Paul's either making the argument from beauty or a teleological argument. And like I said, the argument from beauty is really a subsection of the teleological argument. Now, I wouldn't say this is a pure design argument because he's not driving that point home. Really, he's saying if you look at nature, you can see the evidence of God's handiwork. But if we try to break that down and say, how do we see that? You know, it has to be more than just chirping birds and waterfalls. All of creation proclaims the glory of the Lord. And when we look at it that way, beyond chirping birds and waterfalls, to look at all biological life and even the laws of physics and the entire earth and the solar system and the stars and all of the specified arrangement and specified design of the entire universe and the entire cosmos, then we begin to understand the full weight of Paul's argument. Therefore, I believe this is a teleological argument or a design argument. Now, interestingly, Paul, who is talking to his culture and not ours, well, let me back that up. He is talking to our culture, but primarily he's talking to his culture. So he doesn't spend a whole lot of time defining his terms and getting into the science. But notice that he kind of does for his culture. Who's he talking to? He's talking to Greeks. What's a big aspect of their culture? Idolatry. And so as he builds his argument, as he begins to get to the crux of his argument, he says that they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. If you jump back a few verses, verse 23, they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling man and birds and animals and creeping things. So he's going directly for where the culture is in that case. So for them, it's not atheism and skepticism, it's idolatry. And he's showing how a human being can still deny the proof of God's existence, the proof of God's excellence and his glory in nature, and chase something different. Now, I'm just enough of a modernist to say that I think even our atheists are superior to those idolaters. Because I think the modern atheist uses more reason and evidence and logic to come to their position, but I don't think they're any more right than those idolaters were.
You see, it seems to me that what he's saying, too, in verse 20, is that there really is no atheist. Because he's saying that the world or creation clearly shows who God is, that he is eternal, that he is a Godhead, and they're without excuse.
Yeah, and there's the key. They're without excuse. There is a level of culpability for all persons. I don't want to tell an atheist that they're a liar or a deceiver. It's very possible they're deceived.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah, it's possible that an honest atheist, you can be in a delusion and still be honest, that an honest atheist seeking honest answers has just come to the wrong answers, either because he is deceived by a spiritual being, Satan, or he is being deceived by our society unwittingly. So the society is not necessarily trying to deceive them away from worshiping God, but that ends up being what happens.
And what he's saying is that they clearly understood, but they repressed that knowledge,
mm-hmm.
so that they did not hold on to that knowledge, even though they have it. So it's still a subconscious knowledge.
Yeah, I think that's true. And here's one thing. I want to be fair to atheists. For one thing, because I still feel like God put me through the trials in 2000 for a reason. That he's still going to use me somehow to reach atheists. Maybe when I get to Kansas City, I'll find my niche, because Kansas City actually has a functioning, active, in England they call them Sunday assemblies. They call it Oasis in Kansas City, an atheist, or at very least a skeptic, naturalist worship service, where they get together and sing like John Lennon songs and have a speaker talk about being nice to your neighbor, or you know, some atheist argument. They just bring in a speaker to speak, and I actually kind of like the idea, because at least it gets them engaged in, whether they realize it or not, spiritual concepts, and that gives me an inroad. I much prefer atheists to the old Bill who, and not anybody, I'm old Bill who works down at the feed store who doesn't give a hoot about Jesus and doesn't want to talk about him. I prefer an atheist to that any day, because at least they're giving you an opportunity. And I know evangelism is not one of my strong suits, but if somebody presents an opening, evangelism goes from fingernails on a chalkboard for me to no problem whatsoever. And I know not everybody's wired the same way. For some people, even with the open door, there's still fear. But to me, when the door's open, it's like, woo, yes, let's talk about some Jesus. Or at very least, the teleological argument for the existence of God, and we'll build to Jesus. I get excited when the door is open, because then the stupidest thing an atheist can do, and most of them are logically trained enough that they can realize it if you just point it out, is for them to open the door, and then I walk through the door, and then they get mad at me for talking about Jesus, and I say, you opened up the topic! And then more often than not, they'll realize that. I was like, oh, I guess I did. Sorry about that. Okay, for the rest of our time today, let's look at fine-tuning. Now, fine-tuning primarily is not a biological concept. It's a physics concept. And actually, I have a handout. And I got this right off the internet. I did not write this handout. I just want to make that clear so nobody thinks that I'm taking credit. And you don't have to read all that now, but I just wanted to give you an idea of just how many things in nature are fine-tuned. And so that's a good thing to read if you want to. But basically, when you look at especially the laws of physics, there are four primary forces in nature, and perhaps five. The four primary forces in nature that we know of are the strong nuclear force, and that is basically, in layman's terms, it would be the gravity that holds the nucleus together, the protons and the neutrons, to hold them together. Because if you know anything about magnets, positives don't like to come together. So there's a force in nature that holds those positives together with the neutrons in the nucleus. Then you have the weak nuclear force, which holds the electrons at just the right distance from the nucleus in order to form a functioning atom. You have gravity, and we all kind of get gravity. It's the force of nature which objects within space-time are attracted to each other, and that attraction is directly proportional to their size. And then you have electromagnetism, which is basically magnets and electricity. The fifth possible elemental force of nature would be the cosmological constant. And that is, if I understand it correctly, the expansion rate of the universe. And that expansion rate is at a constant. Although, I've also read articles that say that it's perhaps accelerating, so take it what it's worth. I'm going to fully admit right now I don't understand the cosmological constant very well, so I won't be basing my argument on it very much.
They use that value in a lot of their equations.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with it is, if it is increasing or slowing down or changing in any way, it's not constant anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's no longer a constant.
If you use it in your equations aren't going to come out right if it's wrong.
If we look at these, especially the four elemental forces? Is that a good way of putting it?
If
you look at the four elemental forces in nature, the strong
fundamental,
that makes more sense. The four fundamental forces in nature. the strong nuclear force. If the strong nuclear force were different, if the value of that force was different by 1/1,000,000,000 of a percentage, then if it was too strong, then the nucleus would collapse on itself and you would no longer have protons and neutrons. You would have something else. It would form some other form. Maybe it would just be a collection of quarks and subatomic particles. If that strong nuclear force were 1/1,000,000,000 weaker, then it wouldn't be nearly strong enough to hold the nucleus together. Once again, you would not have atoms. You wouldn't even have hydrogen. Likewise, the weak nuclear force, pretty much the same difference. If the value of the weak nuclear force were, and I think it's once again, I think it's 1/1,000,000,000. If it was 1/1,000,000,000 stronger, then the electron would be part of the nucleus too. And if it were 1/1,000,000,000 weaker, it would fly off and all electrons would basically just be free radiation.
Well, if electrons were forced into the nucleus, the charge would cancel out and all become neutrons. Which is what happened to the neutron star, by the way, but it's due to gravity.
Really? That makes sense now.
It's packed down so much that the electrons are actually forced into the nucleus and it becomes basically...
So you're saying that in a neutron star, gravity actually becomes stronger than the nuclear forces?
Gravity, in its way, is really the strongest force.
Well, see, because I've actually...
If you have enough mass, it's stronger than actually even the...
Yeah, it's the most... Because it's directly related to mass, it's the one that's the most fluctuating. So it can actually be... In most of the universe, gravity is the weakest force, because in most of the universe, there's not stuff. See, we think, like, if you ever watch Star Wars or Star Trek or any kind of space epic, at some point they go through an asteroid field. And, of course, the Millennium Falcon is, barely escaping asteroids here and there. But in a real asteroid field, there would be miles between asteroids.
Many, many, many miles.
Oh, yeah. And because if they really were close, they would just come together.
Yeah.
And that's asteroid fields. And most of the universe doesn't even have that. And so gravity in most of the universe is almost nil. But if you get asteroids and then comets and moons and planets and stars and giant stars and neutron stars, and then black holes, is that gravity that's what's driving it?
Gravity is the only force that can overcome everything else.
So, yeah, so I mean, eventually you get... So because of that, gravity could potentially be the strongest force too. But gravity is the same difference. If gravity were too strong, then, and I don't have a value on this, but I know it's similar to that 1/1,000,000,000. If gravity were too strong, then you wouldn't be able to have any atoms bigger than helium. All the universe would be helium and hydrogen. And if gravity were any weaker, then atoms wouldn't be attracted to each other. So you wouldn't have...
stars either. I mean, if you look at the balance of the star, you've got the fusion furnace in the center that has an outward force.
Mm-hmm.
Its gravity that holds it together has to be balanced with that force. Otherwise, it would either collapse into a black hole or it would explode.
And
it has to be perfectly balanced.
I don't have a fact about electromagnetism, but if you look in that list, I'm sure you'll find one. That list, by the way, for the recording, is godandscience.org/apologetics/designun.html. And God and Science. Oh, here it is at the bottom. This is Dr. U. Ross. Dr. U. Ross is one of the founders of Reasons to Believe. And it's from the book Big Bang Redefined by Fire. That might be a collection. The book looks like it might be called The Creator and the Cosmos, both by Dr. U. Ross. Oh, before I move on, I heard this again on my podcast I heard earlier today, that if you look at all four of the element, once again, fundamental forces in nature, and if you were to look at just how fine-tuned they are, and if you were to look at the odds that the universe would have exactly those values, and even if you were to take it conservatively, like you're not trying to tilt the scales in favor of God. And in fact, a good atheist argument is that if we found out that the universe wasn't fine-tuned, that if somehow that this is just the only way the universe could be, then we would probably find a way to make that a pro-God argument too. And I'll be honest, I probably would. But where we're at now is it looks like that the universe could be fine-tuned to any possible value. That's why atheists, naturalists, a lot of them are going to a multiverse model, where there's not just one universe, but there's dozens, millions, billions, an infinite number of multiple universes, and we just happen to be the one that has the right values. No evidence for that. Or at very least, very, very, very little evidence for it. And what there is, and I've listened to the episode of Unbelievable, where even a Christian cosmologist was arguing for the multiverse, and even the Christian who, based on the, since it was a Christian podcast, had no reason to lie, even the Christian couldn't present very strong evidence. There's just, if there is a multiverse, there's no instruments in our universe that we can use to measure the others. But for the moment, let's just assume that there is no multiverse, that it's just the one universe we have. And if you were to look at just the odds that all of the forces of nature would be just right where they need to be, then the odds of that is 1 times 10 to the 10 to the 127, which is actually more than all of the elemental particles in the universe. So if the odds of winning the lottery is 1 in 365 million, something like that. It's astronomical odds. But if you get 365 million pieces of paper and wrote lose on every one of them except one, the odds are very low that you would get it, but you could still, it's still possible. If we covered Neosho with a piece of paper and have them turned over and you picked one, as unlikely as it would be that you would pick win, it could still happen. Now, in order for the elemental properties or the fundamental properties of nature to be exactly where they need to be, would be like if you wrote lose on every proton, neutron, and electron in existence, and just one of those random protons, neutrons, and electrons, with no guarantee that that random proton, neutron, electron will be on Earth or in our solar system or in our galaxy, but somewhere in all of the universe, just one of those protons, neutrons, and electrons has win on it. That's the odds that there is no God and that the universe fine-tuned itself, or we just accidentally ended up where we are. Even when you factor in reasonable multiverse theories, and by that I say the people who say that there's a literally infinite number of multiverses, there's no scientific theory to account for that. That's just science fiction. Most multiverse theories are based on the idea that at the moment of the Big Bang, that basically within the first couple of picoseconds that it was just bang, 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 and until you have maybe even millions and billions and trillions of universes, but it's still a finite amount of universes. So if there's a finite amount of universes, we're still talking about maybe not 1 times 10 to the 10 to the 127th odds of there not being a God, but we're still talking in like 1 in a number that's the number of stars. We're still talking about an unbelievably, literally an unbelievable low chance that there is no God, that there is no force guiding nature. Let's conclude with the fine-tuning of planet Earth, because I find this one more fascinating, if for no other reason than because we can relate to it more, because it's our beautiful planet and we live here and we can be thankful for all this stuff. For instance, our planet, and Dr. Alberto Gonzalez of Iowa State calls this the privileged planet. We live in the Goldilocks zone, which means every star has a certain distance from that star in which the temperature is just right, it's not too hot, not too cold, so it's the Goldilocks zone, for a life-giving planet to exist in there. And we happen to be within that Goldilocks zone. Our planet circles a stable sun. Remember I'm not old enough, but remember in the 70s where every car had a CB radio? And then CB radios kind of went out of fashion because of the solar flares in the late 70s. I mean, the solar flares were strong enough to interfere with CB radios, but they were never any serious danger to life. In fact, I'm not even sure, I'd have to look at the figures, I'm not even sure it created any heating, any kind of global warming scenarios. And that's the sun at its most active. At its most active, no danger to life. Very stable sun. We are part of a single star solar system, which is helpful because otherwise we would have a very erratic revolution orbit. There you go. Either it would be a lumpy orbit as it circles, or it'd be a figure eight orbit in which it would most likely get too close to one of the stars in the middle of the figure eight.
It might not be very stable either.
Oh yeah, probably not. And gravity with the stars. Okay, this one gets interesting. The tilt of the Earth. The Earth is, as I'm sure you know, is not straight up and down. It's at a 23.5 degree angle. Which, by the way, there's things I learned in college which fascinated me. The tilt of the Earth determines where the Arctic and Antarctic Circle and where the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn are. Did you know that at the first day of winter or summer, depending on which hemisphere you're in, that the tropics become the new equator at high noon? That's what that tropic is. It marks the point in which the Earth is at its greatest tilt for the season, the greatest tilt as compared to the direction of the sun. And likewise, on the first day of winter or summer, the Arctic Circle becomes the North Pole at one moment in time. That's the point of Earth that's straight up and down. So at the first day of winter, the single point on the Antarctic Circle and a single point on the Arctic Circle form a straight up and down. Well, that's all fun and good. Well, what does that have to do with fine-tuning? If the tilt of the Earth were a little bit more straight up and down, then the poles would get way too much cold, and they would develop ice caps so big it would suck the water out of the oceans. Not all of it, but a big amount of it, which would devastate ocean patterns, ocean currents, and those currents help regulate temperatures on Earth, help drive food cycles and the salt cycle of the planet. I wish I had the technical know-how and the time to go into more detail, but it's fascinating. Likewise, if that tilt was a little bit too much, then there'd be no ice caps whatsoever. And we would have water up to about Atlanta, and we would be fine here. We wouldn't be covered by water, but Houston and New Orleans, certainly San Francisco and Manhattan, certainly would be. But more importantly, because if the warming happened quick enough, people could just move inland. More importantly, it would totally disrupt all those ocean currents I talked about. We would have no idea. It'd be totally unpredictable what the results of that would be.
Also, once the polar ice cap starts getting larger, it actually reflects even more heat away, the white of it does, which even makes it even increase.
Mm-hmm. And actually, total bunny trail here. In fact, this is like a moose trail. I saw a thing on Discovery. No, it wasn't Discovery. It was PBS, because it was back when didn't have cable. Saw a thing on PBS one time about this group that are using recycled materials to cover Greenland's ice with a reflective material so that even if the temperature rises, it doesn't melt the snow. And they had no idea whether it would work. And they went out after only 6 months, and the difference was big enough you had to climb up. You had to climb up from the ice shelf up onto the reflective material. So they're thinking if they can, because there's really, to be honest with you, there's no better use for Greenland. It's just covered with ice anyway. They're trying to come up with the funding to try to cover the whole dang island with this. Or at least the center section that we have no known, like no animals live out there and there's no purpose out there except just ice. They're trying to come up with coverings to cover the whole island to slow down the melting. Which I think is fascinating and has nothing to do with our lesson. Okay, so here's more privileged planet. We live in a spiral galaxy. Spiral galaxies are the most stable of all galaxies with the least amount of random radiation. And within that spiral galaxy, we're on a spiral arm. So we're on the outskirts of the galaxy, far away from the interior of a galaxy where the most radiation is, where the life is least likely to survive. Okay, backing off from the galaxy level, let's look back in our solar system. Our planet has a massive, giant, gas, giant planet, not very far away, Jupiter. And we have Saturn and the others too, but Jupiter really, with its size and distance, acts as like a vacuum cleaner to suck in a lot of the things that come into our solar system that might bombard us. And we still get hit with stuff. And we're also lucky, I could throw this in here, I don't think I put it in my notes, but our atmosphere is thick enough that it burns up a lot of that stuff that comes into our atmosphere, burns up a lot of stuff. That's why when you see shooting stars, that's what's happening, is that either space junk or meteors or meteorites are coming through the atmosphere and getting burnt up. But a lot of the really big stuff, that could create a lot of damage for our planet is getting sucked into Jupiter instead. Oh, I did put something on the atmosphere. The size of our planet is just right to hold the kind of atmosphere that we do. If we were bigger, and it's not one of those 1 billionth things, it's more, I think it's, if we were like 10% bigger or something, I mean, we're talking about a bigger range here, but if we were too much bigger, we would get too much atmosphere. And it would be, the pressure on our planet would be really too high for anything other than microscopic or maybe small exoskeleton life. Likewise, if our planet was too small, and scientists are thinking this was actually what happened to Mars, that Mars at one time had an atmosphere and Mars just couldn't hold it. That given enough time that it pretty much all of it went away. Now, Mars still has a little bit of an atmosphere. Just, it's not useful for anything. They've lost too much of their atmosphere, and our planet is just the right size to hold on to our atmosphere.
Our planet also has the magnetic field that deflects a lot of the particles away that Mars doesn't have.
Uh-huh.
It eroded its atmosphere away.
And that's actually on my list, the magnetic field, which, by the way, we have our planet has a core that is, despite its heat, has just the right pressure scenario that allows the core to stay solid. So the core is basically a big magnet, which creates the magnetic fields, which help protect our planet. And the magnetic fields don't so much protect us from physical things like rocks and space junk. It protects us from solar winds that could cook our planet or at very least our atmosphere. And by the way, if you live far enough north or far enough south, I've never seen them. But the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, or the Aurora Australis, I think is the name of the Southern Lights, is the magnetic field, like the magnetic North Pole kind of, it circles around there, and it captures a lot of that solar junk. And what you're seeing is the magnetic field kind of, if I understand it correct, it's pretty much neutralizing it, and in the process making it extremely beautiful.
Like you said, like with the magnets, you've got the charges. You've got the charged magnetic field that is actually thinner at the poles,
mm-hmm.
because it kind of like, here's the pole, kind of goes out like this.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're seeing is, like you said, it gets funneled down that spot, and that's where you see it. But that's why it deflects it, because it's like two of the same charges, it deflects,
mm-hmm.
deflects it away.
Our planet has the right amount of water. If we had too much water, if you had like a water world scenario with no dry ground, there really is no chance for life. Now, granted, within the purview of this class, that yes, our God is powerful enough to create aquatic life, and maybe even we could be aquatic, like some kind of merman scenario. But setting aside that completely fantasy scenario, just from a scientific standpoint, a water world cannot support life. Life wouldn't begin to evolve, and just from a purely scientific scenario. Plate tectonics, our plates are pushing against each other, and other areas they're spreading out. That allows the carbon and silicon cycle of our crust to be cycled in, and with new material for carbon and silicon to be cycled out and new material to be cycled in, which helps keep our planet's crust fertile for plant life. Speaking of fertility for plant life, lightning. Most people don't even think about lightning, but in spring when a thunderstorm rolls in and we get that smell of a first rain, what we're really smelling is nitrogen. And our planet, except for one place in Venezuela, have you ever seen pictures of this place? There's some place scientists have no idea why, but it strikes there all the time. Besides, imagine if the whole planet was that way, but the whole planet's not that way. So our planet, for the most part, has just the right amount of lightning to keep usable nitrogen in our soil without, you know, putting us in a hellish deathscape of electric death all the time. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point, too. I don't know the science behind it. Do you know the science behind
what it is? Normally, oxygen is stable on the two molecules, O2. But with an electric current, it actually will generate the O3, which is ozone.
So ozone's created by lightning.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Well, a lot of times, if you're ever near, like, lightning, like near a strike, and you smell that kind of that acrid smell afterwards, that's ozone that you're smelling. But you don't want to smell too high of a concentration. It's not good for you.
No.
But it's really pungent, so a very uh-huh. small ratio in the air, you can still smell it. But, yeah.
Is that the burning smell?
No, it's more of a... It's not really a burning smell. That's probably... It's hard to explain.
Chances are... I've heard it, and you correct me on this scientifically. I've heard that in cities, when you smell pollution, when you can smell the smog, you're smelling ozone. So what you're smelling.
It could be from all the electrical type stuff. I mean, ozone can be made from any electrical spark.
Uh-huh.
Even ozone generators and stuff like that, they use an electrical field to do it. But in nature, it's lightning that does it.
Okay, so we're right at 7:30, so let's close out real quick. And there's hundreds of these, but the only other one I have on my list is Our Earth has one moon, a single moon, of just the right size that helps keep our rotation steady and predictable. So when you consider these and all the others, and I, like I said, I gave you a list of some other stuff. It's not quite the 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 127, you know, a 1 over all of the elemental properties of the universe number, but it's still pretty big. Hugh Ross says that if you covered North America with dimes and the stack of dimes went to the moon, that 1 in that number is the odds of having a planet this privileged, with so many things just right to have life. It is a number big enough that Carl Sagan's argument of there are billions and billions and billions of planets, ergo there must be another planet like ours somewhere, it's a number big enough to put that assumption into question. Now there could be, just for the sake of honesty, there could be another planet like ours, maybe a few, maybe even 100. But the odds are that there aren't. The odds are that we are a unique and privileged planet. Okay, the criticism, though, and let's be fair, is the anthropological principle. The anthropological principle, you'll hear this a lot from atheists. And by the way, I'm using atheist as kind of a catch-all term. I want to be fair, not every skeptic is an atheist. And not every atheist is a well-versed logical arguer either. So the anthropological principle is this, that yes, these numbers seem unbelievably small, and what are the odds? But the thing is, if we weren't here at all, then there would be no one to marvel at the odds. So what we're really doing is we find ourselves, it's like if I stood at the back of the room and threw a dart and hit the wall, okay? The odds of me hitting the wall from over there, I mean, assuming that I have the arm strength, they're not that bad. But then if I say, hey, Brian, can you hit the exact place where I hit with a dart? And he throws it and he gets within like a foot or two, but he doesn't hit the exact spot. Basically, what the atheist is saying is you're just playing with numbers. You start with an arbitrary figure. So what is this? Is this a hole? So let's say that's a little putty. So let's say that's where I hit. So when I started my throw, I could hit anywhere. There was no special spot that I needed to hit. But then once I hit, then we have a special spot. And then Brian has to replicate the act. It doesn't really show that I have a greater skill in darts. It just shows that I was playing with a different set of rules. I had a different set of odds, and I had a different goal. The anthropological principle says that none of these numbers that we've brought up with the fine-tuning of the universe or the privileged planet scenario, none of these numbers are all that impressive because we're here to see it. It's an observer effect. Dr. William Lane Craig gives a really good analogy, and I don't think he originated it. Because now that I think about it, when he gave the analogy, I think he credited somebody else. But I'm going to go ahead and credit him, secondarily. He gives the analogy of a firing squad. So you're in an unnamed Middle Eastern country evangelizing, and you get caught. And you get put in front of a firing squad, and they blindfold you up and tie you to a post, and the sergeant says, "Ready, aim, fire!" And all of the firing squad miss. I mean, they all miss. And then they take the blindfold off and you go, "I can't believe I'm alive. Oh, but wait, it's not that surprising because if I was dead, I wouldn't be here to be amazed about it." That doesn't, just because the anthropological principle comes into effect, and it does, even in that scenario, the anthropological principle is in effect. You are an observer, you're able to observe the phenomenon, but that still doesn't explain away the phenomenon. With the firing squad, you have to assume that something happened. Either they picked these yahoos off the street, and this is the first time they've ever fired a gun, or perhaps the sergeant and the shooters are actually secretly Christian and don't want you to die, or there's some political game that's going on. Maybe the sergeant is at odds with the mayor of the town and wants to secret you away as a big middle finger to the mayor, whatever. Something's going on. Something's happening. You can't just explain away a phenomenon by pointing to the anthropological principle. All right, next week, intelligent design, and following that, we will discuss evolutionary theories and Genesis 1. Now, the first is Easter, so we're going to take Easter off so that everybody can have time with their family. On the 25th, I'm probably going to do, if I arrange my material well enough, I want to do the resurrection. Evidence for the resurrection, which in my opinion is the strongest of all apologetic arguments, and we'll see when we get there. And that is thematically right up with Easter. So if I time it correctly, we will do intelligent design next week, moving into creationism and my analysis of Genesis 1. And then on the 11th, I want to do kind of a summary. Though we'll save the resurrection arguments for 2 weeks from there, I want to go ahead and summarize apologetics at that point.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Blue Collar Scholar, please like and subscribe to The Blue Collar Scholar in Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast distributor. Writing a review, leaving a 5-star rating, and sharing links to this episode in your social media accounts is much appreciated. The Blue Collar Scholar has been written, recorded, and edited by Will Wrights. The opening and closing music for this episode is Royalty-Free Acoustic Guitar Summer Song by LP Studio Music from Pixabay. Any factual errors made in the preparation or recording of this podcast are unintentional, and your feedback is welcome. You may contact me at thewillwrights@gmail.com. That's thewillwrights@gmail.com. This podcast is primarily a theology and history podcast, though any topic may be addressed. The purpose of this podcast is to educate. Use and distribution of this podcast can only be done by the express written permission of the content creator of this podcast. I hope that you have enjoyed this episode, and I hope that you come back for more. And thank you.